Dr. Steed is here again this afternoon. He's going to present his material. Following that, we will have a Q&A. And the person who will moderate at that time is Lawrence Defer. He's our religious liberty ministry leader here at Central Church. He's also an attorney himself, and we're glad that you're here also, Lawrence. So let's bow our heads, and we'll have a word of prayer. Loving Father in heaven, we praise you for your goodness, your love to us. And we thank you for this precious entity, if I may use that term, of religious liberty. We know it's viciously under attack around the globe, and even in this country we see ominous signs. But we're still thankful for what we do have. We're thankful for all the blessings you give us. And we're thankful that Elder Steed can be here this afternoon. So bless this time together. And we thank you and praise you in the name of Jesus. Amen. Dr. Steed, thank you very much. The time is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming back this afternoon. And I'll talk for a while and then we can have question and answer. History is very interesting, and if you remember, and if not, I'm reminding you, it's not much more than a year ago that we were celebrating 500 years since Luther's part of the Reformation. Or to put it another way, Luther has been put as the defining point for the Reformation. But if you know anything about the Reformation, it was over many hundreds of years. And John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation, was, 100, 150 years before, where he had his followers called Lollards fanning out across England. And like Luther, though, Wycliffe escaped execution, but such was the hatred for John Wycliffe that years later, after he'd been dead and buried, they dug him up, desecrated his body, burned it, and threw his ashes in the river to be cast right, left and center. The hatred of truth was pretty high. But Seventh-day Adventists count ourselves as the inheritors of the Reformation. And it's worth remembering we're not the only ones, but as time goes by, we're one of the few groups that remember the tenets of the Reformation. And in repeating some of those anymore, we put ourselves dangerously close in public sensibility to sort of speaking hate talk. But it shouldn't really be that way, but it's become very acceptable nowadays for Protestant leaders of all stripes to profess great admiration for the Pope of Rome and for the role of the Roman Catholic Church, and to roll back effectively the Reformation. It was decades ago now, I remember when Pope John Paul II came to the US, and when he got off the plane, I think it was in Baltimore, probably at BWI where I often fly out of. But I remember the picture very clearly. He got down and kissed the ground, and the headlines in major US newspapers said, "The Reformation is over." So for us to see prophetic developments in some of these comings and goings of church leaders, and in particular of Rome lately, it's not unnatural. It's staring us in the face. What is sad is that so many other Protestants really have forgotten their heritage. The Baptists are one of our few, or at least elements of the Baptist Church. In particular, the Baptist Joint Committee based in Washington, representing them to the government, is one of the few organizations that we think exactly alike nowadays on separation of church and state. And maybe I'll talk a little bit more about what that really is. But the Lutherans, what I was fishing for, the Lutherans, or the World Lutheran Federation, 20-some years ago now, signed a joint declaration with the Roman Catholic Church after much discussion, where they said that Luther's emphasis on righteousness by faith was a misunderstanding, and that Catholics and now Lutherans see this exactly the same. And guess who's changed? Not Rome that I can see. And only a few years ago now they came out with a second document that said there is no longer any impediment to full union between the two companies. Whether or not there will be. And this is something that Adventists should understand. I think now it's plain enough that we may not ever see all of the Christian world united under one, as one single organization. But what we're clearly seeing is religious groups giving themselves over to one mind, to one leadership. And in that regard, I need to tell you about some developments, ending with the document that lay behind the Pope's visit to, what is it, nearly four years ago. That document was Laudato Si. A bit before that, I went to an all-day seminar at Catholic University, an all-day seminar that they'd put on for religious liberty. It was only for Catholics, although not closed to other people, but there essentially were only a handful of Lutherans, and obviously one, at least, actually three Adventists were there. And it was an interesting day. It began with a speech by Cardinal Dolan. I don't know if, I think he's still head of the U.S. bishops, Catholic bishops. He was then relatively newly minted cardinal from New York. An interesting guy. He sort of, the type of guy that most people, not Adventists, would be happy to drink a beer with and watch a football game. You know, he's a hail fellow well met. That's his persona. Very approachable. And so with a couple of Adventist lay people, I came into the meeting and we sat right down in front under his nose, table right close to him, and he got up and he started talking about religious liberty. And he said very nice things. And you must understand, in the surreal world of religious liberty and constitutional professions lately, there are interesting and strange bedfellows. The Roman Catholic Church insists that it believes in separation of church and state. The Protestant, right-wing Protestant leaders typically do not. I don't know how many of you listen to right-wing Christian radio and some of their talk shows and presentations. They are very angry about the First Amendment. They spit on the separation of church and state. They say it's not in the Constitution. Just because the words are not used, First Amendment says, do you know what the First Amendment is? Actually, it's only half of the First Amendment we're interested in. It talks about freedom of the press and so on. But on religious liberty, it says, Congress shall make no law establishing religion, nor prevent the free exercise thereof. To me, it's sort of plain. The government, federal government, should be out of the religion business altogether. They're not to establish or support it in any direct way, and they're not to stop its practice in any direct way. Off, hands off. Thomas Jefferson, who had a lot to do with a lot of the Constitution and everything to do with the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, which was an echo of the First Amendment, he said that that thereby erected a wall of separation. So that's where the language came from. It was contemporaneous language, not something manufactured, but whatever. The religious right today hate the separation of church and state. Catholics not. They are quite free in speaking about separation of church and state, but with a qualifier. They have adopted a model called the principle of subsidiarity. In other words, there's church and state separate, but the state is subsidiary to the power of the church. So that's not separation, it's just waiting for the appropriate moment. But anyhow, Dolan spoke very nicely, said some good things. They were all in the line of freedom of, thank you, of healthcare and so on. They were, remember, the Catholic hospitals were really getting up against Obamacare. And he was holding forth, and then in the middle of it, he stopped. And I'm just under his nose. So I could see what was happening. He was doing what many people that speak in public were doing. He knew his topic, and he's talking, and he's having a little inside discussion with himself. And he'd reached the end of his statement, and he sort of didn't have anything buffered. So he just stood there, and then he blurted this out. He said, you know, he said, Roman Catholics would would not have spoken this way about religious liberty. He said, "We once held that error has no rights." And then he continued on, finished, and just a few seconds later, oh, happy, comes down and flops down next to me. And, pleases himself. And so I introduce myself, and I'll take credit for it, but nothing came of it. I invited him to our church to come and have a sit-down protocol lunch, and he says, "Oh yeah, I'll come. And but he says, "You won't have the right thing for me to drink, will you?" And we were laughing, but I know what that was. He was just code telling me, "I know all about you people." But as it turned out, he didn't come because it would embarrass a lot of people. But it's not bad talking to these people, and you need to understand on religious liberty, or at least public affairs, it's reasonable to have lines of discussion. That in itself is not compromise, right? But anyhow, my wife. that's not compromise. After his speech, they had a break, lots of alcohol, and my father was temperance director, and there's a huge problem that they never much talk about with alcoholism in among the priests. And in fact, a couple of years later, I was at another event at the Catholic University, and Archbishop Lurie of Baltimore got up and told a big scary story about this present Pope. And so afterwards I went and talked to him, and I said how I'd made a contact with Dolan, and he'd made the joke about not having the right thing to drink. And he says to me, he says, "Oh yes, he likes his liquor." So that's sort of a subtext. But anyhow, they broke between the first session and the second. And on the second session, there was a historian, a Catholic charities person, and a theologian. And I forget their topics, but they were, the types of things that each of them would speak about. But it was on the program. The minute they reassembled, people started calling out from the audience, "What was the Cardinal talking about? What was he talking about?" And they spent the entire session telling that overwhelmingly Catholic audience what Cardinal Dolan was talking about. And they had to be told, and this is a way to tell you, what had changed. Because for hundreds of years, that was the position. Error has no right. It's not that you're wrong and you differ from the church's position, but the church will not grant you the right to be wrong. You're going to be punished for it. You have no right to exist in certain cases in the old world. And they were told what had changed, and it was Vatican II. Back in the 60s, for several years, old Pope John called a church council, and with their conceit, it's the whole Christian church, but obviously all the Catholic representatives for the whole world, met for several years to try to modernize the church in many areas, and they went from the Latin Mass to the vernacular, which caused a lot of reactions within their own church. They didn't do away with the unmarried priesthood and so on, but one thing that was major is they adopted a document called Dignitatis Humanae. Father McMurray, I think McMurray was the TV character, but anyhow, Father Murray, an American Jesuit priest, was the one that pushed forward this document, The Dignity of Man. And as with the U.S. Declaration on Human Rights, pretty much in the same language, it said that human beings have the right to change their religion, and as individuals with the conscience and the autonomy, they have the right to choose religion, change religion. They can't be forced. It's a great document. But unfortunately, it runs counter to the historic claims of the Roman Catholic Church. They accepted it. But if you have been watching developments in the last several decades, the last three popes have been opposed. They were John Paul and Benedict were both involved with Vatican II, had something to do with it, but had rethought it and were trying to roll it back. And the last three popes, in their own way, have been trying to distance themselves from many things, including elements of Dignitatis Humanae as far as they relate to religious liberty. So the way I would put it, there has been a change in the Roman Catholic Church. There is a certain openness, and it's an opportunity for all Protestants, including Seventh-day Adventists, to interact with Roman Catholics. It's not as closed a system as it once was, and many individual Roman Catholics, not fully aware of what their own church has held and what views that it presently has, and are now encouraged, even by their own leadership, to study the Bible as they never were before, you can relate to them. But keep in mind, behind the scenes, the advances of Dignitatis Humanae are being turned back progressively. And at some point, I believe, when they have full political power and rights in the West, then it will shed away and they'll be stuck with their historic position. Because it's not a matter of accusing them of gross error. Structurally, the Roman Catholic Church finds it very hard to change. When you have the assumption of a divine mantle I've got to watch my words. It's not that they cannot make a mistake, but you know, they're standing in for God. You know, they've appropriated that statement, anything you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and so on. And the way they state it, the magisterium of the Catholic Church is incapable of error. Well, when you have the magisterium's representative, popes in particular, with edicts saying, and different, they have different categories, there's pastoral letters and bulls and so on, but when they have clearly stated things against freedom of choice and you're not right to have an error, you're not allowed to have error, then Vatican II sort of shows up as an aberration. So it's very easy for them to revert to their long-standing view. A few years ago, since I've been editing Liberty, a whole sequence of magazines, a sequence of documents have come out that sort of underscore some of the things I've talked about. The ecumenical movement, of which we dabbled with as a church, but never joined. And I know enough about what's happened in our church leadership. There have been a number of people working with the World Council of Churches that might have gotten us more involved than we have been, but they've never been allowed to follow through on it. And we've never joined, we've only been observers, and that seems reasonable to me. You know, that hasn't caused us any trouble, but I'm trying to think the point I'm trying to make. Totally lost my train of thought on the Roman Catholic Church. But anyway, I know where I'm trying to head. The document even our Adventist Church was dabbling a bit with this, but the ecumenical movement had a wide appeal to many Christian groups, not so much, you know, desperate to join again with Rome, but in our era, with, you know, World Wars I and II on the other side and all sorts of horrors. This was before the Islamic terrors of recent years. You know, they didn't want religious conflict, so they were trying to kiss and make up with Romanism. And that movement sort of reached its fruition, I think it was about 10, 12 years ago, with a document called The Unicity of Salvation. Came out of Rome. And that put the, you know, just put ice on the thing, because what Rome said there, they said, unless a church shares the Eucharist with Rome, they are not a church at all. So that really put the cat among the pigeons. And then there was another document that they know about, that you know about. It was popularized in different news reports. It was called the Memory and Reconciliation. And in the popular press, it was Rome apologizes for the Reformation, for the Inquisition, to counter the Reformation. They apologized for the persecution of the Jews. They apologized for the Crusades, or at least the one against Constantinople. And there were a few other apologies. But I read the document. Very interesting. The document drew a parallel that's most startling. It says, first of all, it said, can you really even hold people responsible for the actions of former ages? But it says, just as Christ, holy and undefiled and incapable of error, took upon himself the sins of fallen human beings, so the magisterium of the church, holy and undefiled and incapable of error, will apologize for the actions of fallen human beings. So it was sort of a non-apology, in my view, and then it finished by speaking directly to Protestants, and it says, we've apologized, this calls for reciprocity. So there are clear efforts to draw the children of the Reformation back to the Mother Church. And a number of you know one thing. If you know nothing else, you know the Kenneth Copeland set piece that happened a few years ago. You know, that was no document, there was no binding element on it, but it did sort of play out as a morality play the dynamic that is going on right now. It was Kenneth Copeland's TV program, and he had a number of leaders there for leadership training. I think it was a setup myself, because I've investigated a few elements, and Tony Palmer, an Episcopal priest, sort of lectured them all about how the Reformation's over. The trouble is, Tony Palmer, who it's hard to prove it, but he supposedly died on a motorcycle crash shortly after. But Tony Palmer was not quite a free agent. I found out he'd worked many years with Kenneth Copeland, and at the time of the video, he was holding an ordinariate with the Catholic Church in Rome. You know, they have allowed Church of England and some other Protestant groups to hold positions in the Catholic Church. They're not quite regular priesthood positions, but they're called ordinariates. But anyhow, Tony Palmer lectured the group that the Reformation's over and that they really need to drop their pretense of being different from Rome and join the Mother Church and so on. And then he says, you know, I have a message from a friend of mine. And there was an even older guy on the screen when they put it up, and there was the Pope in his private quarters, pre-recorded, I think, but it might have been live. It was from his iPhone. And the Pope drew an analogy that I would have found offensive if I'd been in that audience, because he drew a parallel between Joseph and his brethren. Remember, the brethren had betrayed Joseph, sent him into slavery. And the Pope says, and here, he says, Joseph's brethren go to Egypt looking for food, and they find their brother. So there's reconciliation. So he says, come back. In other words, you are the brothers who have wronged the church. But he said, doctrine's not important. Let's just unite in the body of Christ. And I found over and over, this is their appeal, even though doctrine is seriously important for them. As a follow-on to that, I hunted the background of Tony Palmer, and I found that he wasn't really in a regular Episcopal group. It was a subset, mostly in India, a few in the US, and some in South Africa. They were a convergence church designed. The whole reason to be was to bring all the churches together under Rome. And I found that their secretary general was in Orlando, and I was going to Orlando, so I called him up, found where he was and his number, and I called him up and I said, I want to come talk to you. And he told me a lot. He said that 20 of them were going back to talk to the Pope shortly after about, they had continuing discussions about unity. And I said, can I come with you? Well, I'll have to check with the group. He never checked back. I'm sure they don't want Adventists in that group. Any people with a Protestant sensibility. But he repeated the Pope's statement. Doctrine's not important. We're not saved by doctrine. And I hear Adventists say that all the time. It's an easy, cheap thing to say. And I said to him, well, I said, that's narrowly speaking true, but it seems to me doctrine is the skeleton of your faith. You need to have structure. But without faith, you can't be saved, obviously. He says, no. Doctrine's not important. So I thought I'll tease him a bit. So I said, well, maybe you're right. I said, maybe it's time for the Catholic Church to put aside its doctrine of transubstantiation. And, oh, man, the shock. No way, he said. He said, do you know, he said, that they've done a DNA test recently of the host elevated during the Mass, and he says it's tested positive for the DNA of a 30-year-old Middle Eastern man. And I hope that's not true. If it were true, it confirms what the Roman Empire said about the early Christians. You know, we're not eating transferred flesh in any form of the Last Supper. It's a symbol. Studying literature, as many people do, and that was my thing. It's easy to spot an analogy or a symbol, but they've taken it literally. But doctrine is important, and it reminded me, in Australia, years ago, when I was back there, I went back to Australia working for 9 years between 76 and 85. They formed a uniting church while I was there. I can't recount the different organizations, but there were about five fairly mainline Protestant groups that united into a single entity. And it clearly, in my view, was a trial run for what they might do elsewhere. And so for a year or so, we had all sorts of personages come by. World Council of Churches, a guy, he was a West Indian that year. Two Archbishops of Canterbury and other various historians came by and were on TV. And I remember on one occasion, the then Archbishop of Canterbury was interviewed about this. And he said the same thing. Doctrine's not important. He says, you must understand. He says, the theologians, they debate these things endlessly. But he says, real unity takes place when the members of one church sit down for afternoon tea. Remember, this was Australia with the cup of tea mentality, like England. But he says, the members sit down for an afternoon cup of tea, and that's how it really happens. He says, so, if you have doctrinal differences, he says, put them aside. We can discuss that after we join. And the TV interviewer was very honest and very persistent, and he said, well, that's fine. He says, but what if after there's unity, we can't resolve the doctrinal differences? And I'll never forget the answer. The Archbishop's eyes hardened, and he says, well, he says, it's like a diseased part of the body. It must be cut off and destroyed. We shouldn't buy this cheap commonality idea, kumbaya, we're all Christians. Ideally, that should be. But the unity should be on basic principles of Christianity, not just because we want to form a grand confederation that ignores very particular misunderstandings in some cases on what it is to follow Christ. In total, I see a great challenge, a positive challenge with Roman Catholicism at the moment. We can talk to them. I don't think they automatically see any other group as their sworn enemy. But you must understand, they come from the assumption this is the old church, the mother church, and they'll be kind and indulgent with you, but they'll talk to you. And the members are wandering. Just yesterday, I went on YouTube and I heard a Catholic historian talking about the scandals within the Catholic Church, and their take on it is the devil is picking on them greatly, and they need to pray for their priesthood and so on. But they're wondering. Again, I made the comment from Ellen White. I believe many of them are looking wistfully to heaven, and they're open to explanations as to what does this mean. And surely there's a place for Adventists, or indeed anyone else that remembers the Reformation, to remind them of the distinctions. And I'll finish this element of what I want to say by going to another Catholic presentation, not a document, but a presentation, the first major one by Benedict, the Pope Mother equivalent. He's, the Queen Mother is the one sitting behind the scenes. He's still alive, sitting in Rome. He just knows what he's doing. But when he first started, he was an academic, and he had taught at Regensburg University. And I've come to believe nothing that happens with Rome is by chance. They think through every little detail. And even the Pope's speech in Rome, I've forgotten some of the things that are going on. There was a blood moon at the time. It was the Day of Atonement was there. Everything. It was like the chicken guts were all at the right point. This is when he had to come give the speech. They think through everything. And so for him to give a speech from Regensburg University, very significant, because Regensburg was one of the main centers of the Counter-Reformation in Germany. Pope Benedict got up and he spoke about the Reformation. But you, if you have a memory of it, only remember that he started global riots by Muslims objecting to his speech. Remember that? And the damage control took a lot. He went to Constantinople and even prayed toward Mecca in the Blue Mosque. An amazing moment, but I read his speech and he had no intention of insulting Islam. He had every intention of boxing Protestants and chasing them toward Rome, because what he did was he started off with an example from the Middle Ages of an Islamic army that was besieging Constantinople. And again, he threw that in for a reason. Their enduring conflict is the great schism between the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Church of Rome. It's over many things, but mostly over the primacy of the Pope. The Eastern Orthodox Church wouldn't accept it. But the Eastern Orthodox Church was the Christian Church. People have forgotten it. It was the church at the center of Rome, the Church of Constantine. It was the left-behind Bishop of Rome in the fading ancient capital of Rome that in the vacuum asserted himself, as I referred to earlier, sent one of the Crusades to sack Constantinople, and then Muslims finished it later. So very significant, in my view, for the Pope to quote something from that era. And he quoted a dialogue between the emperor, the then emperor, and I forget his name, of Constantinople, and one of the generals of the army, an Iranian Muslim. And again, very significant. If there's one single historic development within Islam, it was the conversion or the conquest and conversion of the Persian Empire to Islam. To this day, I don't think American policymakers quite understand Iran is not an Arab country. They're not Arabs, nor did they have an ancient tradition Islam itself's not ancient, but they were converted by force to Islam. And so this dialogue was interesting, and they got to discussing in this historic dialogue violence in religion. The Pope, I think, thought it was just a given that Islam advances through violence, but he was building his case for something bigger. Then the Pope goes on, and the rest of his speech was on the central question, violence in religion. And he said Christianity, too, was once violent, which is a false premise, in my view. Think about your church history. Early Christians, persecuted by Rome, went, as the Roman authority said, too easily to the lions. They were passive. They didn't resist very much. But the Pope's point, take his point, accept it at face value, even though it's wrong. He says Christianity, too, was once violent. But what made it non-violent was accepting Hellenistic rationality. Well, you and I could say, or should say, that was paganism. When they took on a pagan overlay, they were less sure of themselves, so they weren't as violent, according to him. But then he devoted the rest of his speech to three threats today, or movements that would turn Christianity again violent, like the Islam that he'd invoked at the beginning. The last two were just variants on his take. If you remember Benedict, he was always hung up on secularism. It was a big enemy. And I can tell you in advance that lots of our religious liberty people, even within our church, see the battle as between faith and secularism. And they even try to say it's a religion. And they're negligent to refer to our prophetic understanding that it will be a religious coalition supported by a global force but headed by the United States that is likely to restrict conscience, not secularism, right? So those were his second points. But I'll tell you the first point. Very interesting. I've almost memorized it. He says, the reformers, he means Luther, Zwingli, Huss, and so on, the reformers, by their insistence on sola scriptura, exposed Christianity again to violence. That's a pernicious message, because he's compared that drift toward violence created by sola scriptura to the Islamic fundamentalists who, in the name of Allah and quoting the Quran, will slit your throat. And you can debate forever whether they're representing true Islam. But that's what's happening. That's the fear that's gripped the whole Western world. And one of the reasons why nobody will say one word out of line about Islam, and curiously enough, why nobody reads the Quran. Erroneous statements made all the time by people that have never cracked the book. Read it and then maybe talk on it. But here's a Pope saying that you as a Protestant, and this is Adventist claim, is inherited of the Protestant Reformation, that it's the sola scriptura, the Bible and the Bible alone. Of course we have Ellen White, we have other helps for us, prophetic helps, but at the end of the day, we depend on the Bible only, and you've got to live or die by the Bible says, not by some church father or some papal edict. But in Benedict's proclamation to the world, you are, you know, you're developing a violent streak by insisting that way. Very interesting. Let's talk about the United States for a little bit. Wonderful country. I mean, it's not a critique of the US. I love the US. I mean, Australia's a nice place too. England's a nice place. The Western world is a nice place. We have to accept, and too few, Americans don't seem to understand that they're part of a global movement for democratic ideals. It wasn't just the US that came out of the Enlightenment and itself which came out of the Reformation, but you know, we've got some wonderful modern democratic states, and the US has been a guiding light ever since its inception, because while it's not necessarily any innately it's not more innately morally superior to anybody else, I think through the Constitution it put out a wonderful, a beacon to move toward. And, you know, a number of our citizens here understand this. The Constitution, which is fine and it contains wonderful truths within it, also enshrines some pretty bad stuff. You know, the slavery's there. The percentage representation of human beings, not representation, but the value ascribed to them, not even as a vote, but for weight for different states, damning. Women had no vote in the original Constitution. You know, we fixed that up. But you need to understand it's a human document. And if I don't know what other religious liberty people you've heard about, but I've reminded people from time to time, the Constitution is, we can be proud of it, as Americans, obviously. It's a secular document, and our religious liberty department use it all the time to defend you in the workplace because it grants certain rights of accommodation. But don't think it's perfect. If you look at it the way we look at Holy Scripture, it will betray you one day. I'm sure of it. Not to mention the fact that much that goes on is not even covered or countenanced or in harmony with the Constitution. I used to think, growing up as a Seventh-day Adventist, where we were paranoid about constitutional conventions, I used to think that we needed a constitutional convention and change to arrive at the point of persecution that we see in Revelation 13, for example, prefigured in Revelation 13. I don't think so anymore. I'm sure till the end of time, it'll sit nicely under glass. People will come and ooh and ah about it, and it will be thrown off as with hushed tones, or the Constitution does whatever. But think about it now. Nobody's bothering you or me yet, but many principles of the Constitution have been absolutely flung aside, even in the last few years, certainly since 9/11. And I've learned big time in dealing with religious liberty that the law operates on precedent. And if a precedent's been set, the next time the precedent will be referred to. I've got a book that was given to me early on by one of the religious liberty, or recommended to me early on by one of the religious liberty directors. It was written by then Chief Justice Rehnquist, called All the Laws But One. And he goes back in US history looking at actions of different presidents. Detention, imprisonment, and curtailed rights of Japanese Americans, for example. Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus and rounding up hundreds of enemies without charge or trial, things like that. And the title of the book is citing the Roman maxim that in times of war or emergency, all laws are silent. And that's still the principle here. Think about it at the moment. The president's threatening to invoke emergency powers. When I came into the job, I remember in the English system, there's the War Powers Act in an emergency. They suspend basically every right that you take for granted. And it can be done like that. So, we need to keep that in mind, that the Constitution, good document, we work with it, we respect it, but obviously, sola scriptura for us. That's our point of reference. Don't confuse holy documents of God, divine holy documents, with holy state documents. We respect the Constitution. Paul, remember when he was brought before the Romans, he referred to his citizenship and the rights that came under it. He used it as far as... Do you think Paul thought that Rome was God's kingdom on earth? Of course not. But I don't remember him speaking badly of their law at all. They were an empire of laws, and he used it as far as it went, recognizing that at root it was a system opposed to God. And at root... any system is opposed to God. Think about it. A capitalistic system, which is not really enshrined in the Constitution. Well, I take that back. You can look at the Constitution as a contract document, as an ownership document. That's why slaves have a certain weight as property. It was a property document. And we need to see it as that. We need to look past human things and keep God's law in mind. And I'm afraid that in the United States particularly, Adventists are a little vulnerable to getting confused between the two. We should thank God every morning that we live in a benign state and pray that freedom for the whole and for us in particular exists as long as possible. But don't ever slip to thinking this is your divine mandate. It's not. It will betray you one day. One, even without prophecy, I could make that statement. Every human system from the beginning of time goes wrong eventually because it has human nature behind it. And under stress, all human systems break down. I guess it's not a secret because I've said it before, but I'll just give you one example of what's in store for us. Years ago, it's now over a decade ago, as a guest of an Adventist lawyer who's far too politically involved, he took me along as his guest to a right-wing political planning group in Colorado Springs. And I still don't know how he got me in, because I was in a number of meetings just with their board, about 10, 12 or so members. And there were three ex-Reagan cabinet members. There were two billionaires, I remember, and so on. And on the Sunday morning of that group, we had a breakfast reception just for the board in a little room. And while we were talking, we listened to a presentation by General Eberhardt. I noticed he's retired recently. Nice guy. He didn't offend me in the slightest. But what he said made my spine tingle. And I was on the middle table, and there were just three tables. And he's maybe 6-7 foot in front of me. And he told us their plans for martial law in the U.S. Now... hasn't happened yet, might not happen for another 10 years, but it's certain. I heard the details. They're planning it. They're expecting to have martial law in the U.S. You think when there's martial law that all the niceties of the Constitution are going to be applied to you? Like as he started to talk about it, and I've not memorized all that went on, but I remember one thing. When things explode all across the country, some cities with circular freeways, they're going to put a military cordon around and let them stew in their own juice. Remember what Ellen White said? Get out of the cities. Bad things are likely to happen. While he was talking, I said to my friend, I said, what are they going to do with the detainees? Are they going to give them to the police? Oh, yeah. I said, I don't think so. When the tank comes down your street and they either shoot a few people and others panic and run and they grab them, they don't hand them over to a judge. They have no evidence. They put you in a military stockade and then quick... justice before a tribunal and then maybe before a wall or whatever, but it's a whole different system. And the general must have heard me because he stopped And he says, some people may have problems with what we're planning because of posse comitatus laws. But he says, we see no problem because of changes to the law. I don't even know what the changes are to this day. And like I say, I didn't feel threatened by him. They're doing what you would expect the authorities to do. They see the world collapsing around them and they're making full-blown contingency plans. And so go and read Great Controversy again. Those last few chapters are a gothic scenario of centralized control diminished. It's like a sphere of influence. You go here, but it's dark here, it's lighter here. That's what's ahead for us. But God will protect those, remember, that are on his side. And that's the message you need to keep in mind. But if you're depending upon wonderful constitution, cleverly applied forever, it's not going to happen. And I'm not political. I intend never to vote. But, you know, I watch all of this stuff, and I remember Ellen White's quotes. Several occasions, Ellen White said that any pastor or teacher that's involved with party politics or partisan politics should resign or be fired. We're not, as a church and church representatives, to be involved in the political machinations around us. It's your right as an individual. You're a citizen. You can be as involved as you want. But the church shouldn't, and it shouldn't dabble in that because you get burned by it. Apart from deceived. I hope that that's what guides Liberty Magazine and me. But we have to comment on political developments because politics are all the civil events surrounding us. And, you know, we really need to be clear about this. We're not partisan, but it does bother me that an awful lot of Seventh-day Adventists at the moment, and I get the feedback from them, are reflexly closing ranks with hardline political conservatives, and it's their individual right, but they're confusing it with what we hold as a church. And I believe it will end badly. And if you study modern movements of conservatism, and or better word is reactionary political movements, that they can get quite vicious. And it's always dangerous to make comparisons, but Germany, between the wars, was going through much the same stuff that we're going through now. Moral decline, monetary debasement, societal upheaval. There's a lot of evidence to give to it, but the one you might remember, just if you know anything about this famous musical that came out of Hollywood, Cabaret, that was German nightlife between the wars. The transvestitism and homosexuality run amok, and it bothered the people out in the country. And so when someone like Hitler presented, they were there for the taking. And the Jews certainly were an attempt made to exterminate them, but the first people to go to the camps were the communists, the mental defects, the prostitutes, the transvestites, the Jehovah's Witness, anybody that was seen as un-German. And today, un-America. Make America great again. That's a great concept, and I hope it plays out, but it can easily be used badly. And in the last few months, we've seen political parties diminished and subverted. We've seen the press, which is called the fourth estate. It's part of what keeps modern democracies honest and people informed. The press directly attacked and treated as the enemy, and said directly, I'm not even enemy, they're the enemy. We've seen the judges, so-called judges, treated very badly. Where else can I go? And as I say, talk about open talk about detaining whole groups of people. There's a discussion now. I'm not even discussing it, they're just stating they saw no problem with the detention of the Japanese Americans. We need to do the same thing. And there's open discussion from the top about why can't we use nuclear weapons. We are in a very bad state right now. We need to, of course, pray for this country. And as Seventh-day Adventists, we need to lift up our eyes because our redemption's drawing near. And not cast loose from the country, but know things for what they are. You know, if this hasn't startled us, what would it take? Like, how many steps are we away from things so changing that they're unrecognizable? I don't know what steps it'll be, but you know, you could easily find a Sunday law appearing at a moment's notice. Think about 9/11. You know, it's not real clear really what happened at this late point, but we know the effects of 9/11. It shook us to our core. And I listened to the legislators. Within the several days, they were presented with the Patriot Act. And I remember the head of the Ways and Means, but anyhow, the head of the main committee that had to approve it, he said to Attorney General Ashcroft, he said, "Tell me why we should pass this." He says, "It's nothing but a grab bag thing of a bag full of things that the far right have wanted for decades." They didn't answer him. Gone. It was through in a couple of weeks, maximum. Things that turn back basic liberties that you haven't noticed because they're not applied against you, but privacy is a thing of the past with most of those changes. The ability of people to be detained. And you know, we're way over it now. Just on a say-so in a few people in Washington, citizens can be liquidated by rockets from the air. That's no due process. It's incredible. All like that. So, you know, the idea of Sunday law being distant, we don't know. But don't imagine it's going to slowly emerge. Ellen White says that it's making its way in secret. Not totally secret, but out of the line of sight. And so it can be developed and then suddenly appear full-blown. And in that regard, I'll tell one more document that you probably know about, but I've hardly ever found an Adventist that's read it. When the Pope came to Washington, he didn't quote from his document, but behind everything he said was a document called Laudato Si, Praise Be to Thee. And this document starts off by putting out an image, and it says, the earth is like our little sister. She's dying. And he says, what are we going to do to save our sister? And he said, this document is not to Roman Catholics, or not just to Roman Catholics, not just to Christians, it's to the whole world. And he says, unless we save this sister, save the environment, we are all going to die. Now, that's a document that will get everyone's attention except certain party at the moment. But I think eventually people will see it. And even in a super cold winter, I know the average person, global warming. Forget, global warming means whipsaw weather. Super hot, super cold, but tending toward warm. But anyhow, he for 120 pages, pushes this line on the need for the whole world, the whole globe to mobilize to save itself because we're in ecological meltdown. There's two lines of argument, like in a lot of these documents. There's the civil argument, and underneath it, in parallel to it, he has a theological argument. Very early on, he said, in this effort to save mankind and the earth from destruction, he says, we need to recognize the rhythms, this is his term, the rhythms inscribed in nature by the Creator. And he said, along those lines, the seventh day Sabbath is the thing we need to obey. And he says, it's not just for man, it's for animals. And if you read the Sabbath prescription in the Old Testament, it's actually way beyond just a human being. It's an earthly rest. And so he says it directly, and quotes the Bible. From the seventh day Sabbath, the animal, the stranger that's within your gates. And remember, that's, again, error has no right. If you're within the gates of this global coalition, using a biblical mandate, you will have to obey. And he repeats this idea over and over again through the document, that it's the seventh day Sabbath that needs to be front and center on this effort to reclaim the world. Only near the end does he say, in keeping the Eucharistic Sunday, we fulfill the seventh day Sabbath mandate. And then at the very end of the document, it has an exultant language, and it says, and as we go move toward that eternal Sabbath, the heavenly Sabbath. So don't think Sabbath is, you know, out of sight, out of mind. It's the big singular part of the final endpoint game. The last significant document that I think you can connect to that was in 2008. I guess it was Benedict back then. Benedict came out with a document, remember, on the heels of the economic collapse, a document that dealt with the ecology, ecological meltdown, financial meltdown, loss of national sovereignty. And you know, Henry Kissinger's taken the lead in this. Most people don't realize what's happening. The world order that we live under is post-Reformation. Remember, there were the wars, 30 wars of, years wars of religion, and out of that, the Treaty of Westphalia established the modern world. Nation states, sovereignty, borders, and the whole thing. It's disappearing. So the outgrowth for states that followed the Reformation is collapsing. So all of these things were dealt with in Caritas et Veritatis, charity and truth. And in the middle of the document, it says this, that there is a need for a global authority with the power to act and to enforce. And one of the magazines that I read, nothing to do with religion, they analyzed it as a political document. By the way, it was given to Obama as he headed to his first G8 meeting after the collapse. And this magazine that analyzed it, they said it's a pretty good prescription for solving most of the world's problems, or addressing them, not necessarily solving. They said, the trouble is, you accept this document, the Pope comes with it. So, you know, you would have to be blind and, I think, negligent and willfully denying the reality that in outlines, or at least at key pressure points, what we're told would happen is actually coming together. And yet for many, it'll be an overwhelming surprise when suddenly the fix is in. These are exciting times. And just in conclusion, before we have questions, to me, you know, it's almost over. Whether it's next year or 10 years, I can't say. It's not given to any of us to know. But we're at the tipping point. Things are speeding up. It's sort of obvious to everybody. The deck is stacked. All these things are in place. And I think we're just waiting for a final crisis. And Ellen White, in her end time statements, is always talking about crisis. Crisis of the ages, an overwhelming surprise, and so on. These things will spring, but yet the elements behind them are really gathering force, and you can see them. But what I see this as is a great moment of opportunity for our church. We have access to government like we've never had before. It's a great irony in it. You know, we can pretty much talk to anybody. We've had like our Liberty Dinner. We have top personages there. We've had John McCain. Post last election, I hate to say it, but we have Hillary Clinton and on. And a number of U.S. ambassadors for religious liberty. Even on my television program, I had the first U.S. ambassador for religious freedom who had worked with us quite a bit. And when I talked to him, I found he didn't even know what we believed. Amazing. But we have the opportunity, and I told him, like he asked me, he says, do Adventists count themselves as Protestants? I mean, there's an open question for you. And so I was able to explain that, of course, we are. And at the end of the day, I'm not under any illusions, he's a Baptist, but when I asked him, or I made a comment about he's now in retirement, I said, I guess you go to the local Baptist church. He says, I say I'm a Baptist, I'm not really. And I said, why don't you join with us? Come with us. Well, maybe I will, you know. But who knows what people will join with us when the crunch comes. There's a lot of people that they don't know everything, but, you know, they understand the way truth should work. And when they see it subverted and force applied, which is the single litmus test of religious liberty, if there's compulsion involved, it's against God's principles of religious freedom. Even if they should require us all to worship on the seventh-day Sabbath. It would be wrong in this modern era. We're not under a theocracy. But we are living in a time of opportunity. Time of opportunity. It's an exciting time. And I hope with again, back to the a week ago and our Liberty Sabbath, I hope that you can be a part of this. Our church has chosen not to directly fund Liberty Magazine and most of what we do with religious liberty. It all comes from annual appeals. And it's been pretty good till now. But, you know, we could do a lot more with a lot more money. I'm very aware, personally, as well as what we're doing with Liberty, that, you know, the money's great now. The dollar seems to be defying all of the reality about its basis. I mean, it's just an idea. The dollar is an idea. And it buys a lot. But, you know, while it's worth a lot, we can put it to use. You know, don't wait till like we like Zimbabwe or
Brazil, where I was. I was in Brazil when they had 1,200% inflation. The stack of money was quite frightening. But there's no limit to how high inflation can get. They've had trillions of percent inflation, I think, in Zimbabwe. I was talking to one Adventist that lived through it, and he said they only existed with bags of food sent from other countries to the workers. But he said if you had a $10 US note, you could break a bank. I forget how he told me, but you finagle it, you could break any bank. Ellen White says the day will come when we throw our money at the church and it'll be worthless. Not worthless now.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.